This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to Slate's Audiobook Club for the month of August 2017. I'm Katie Waldman, a staff writer at Slate, and I am joined today from New York by Slate's book critic, Laura Miller. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Katie.
And by Isaac Chotiner, the host of the podcast, I Have to Ask. Hey, Isaac.
Hi, Katie.
I'm so glad you both could join us. And before we dive in, I should mention that September's book will be Conversations with Friends by Sally Rooney. Now let's get started. Today, we'll be discussing Arundhati Roy's second novel, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. It's a sprawling work about sectarian violence in India and Kashmir, filtered through the eyes of various misfits and rebels and reluctant witnesses, chief among them a transgender woman named Anjub and an illustrator named Tilo. Isaac, I know you interviewed Roy, and Laura, you reviewed the book, so you're both experts.
Well,
do you have to read the book to interview someone? I didn't get that.
Yeah, many people don't. But Isaac, you're holding the line of integrity in that front.
Yeah. Well, Laura, as the reviewer of this book, this is kind of an unusual question, but I wanted to ask you what you think the book's defining quality is.
Oh, that's interesting because I feel that there are a couple of sort of strands of Roy's personality, which is always just been this strong, charismatic aspect of her work that comes through even when she's writing fiction, that are sort of at work in this story, and they're kind of in tension with each other. So you know, like part of her, which is I think the novelist part of her, just really believes in the idea of love as something that is so powerful and has the ability to overwhelm the boundaries between people, and that's what she really believes in as a novelist. But then as an activist, she has ideas about politics and injustice and what should be done about them. And I don't necessarily know that those two things mesh with each other. I mean, like the first attitude is often seen as kind of apolitical. You know, we're all alike. We all should, you know, just accept each other as we are, and love has no boundaries. And then politics is often all about boundaries. So I feel like that's one of the things that made the novel interesting to me. It's not a novel that's full of sort of pat observations about life and trouble and people.
Yeah. I mean, Isaac, when you talked to her, did you have a sense of Roy's activist persona being different from her novelist persona, or were they more integrated for you?
Yeah. Just before, I was just going to add to what Laura said. I was struck by that, too. I was struck by the sort of Laura talked about it in terms of like politics versus art. I was struck by kind of the optimism that she has in the book, in her fiction writing about individual people and allowing them sort of this dignity and the ability to make change and so on, versus her political activism, which I mean, I guess she embodies someone who tries to make change, but she's also just an incredibly pessimistic person. Her evaluations of capitalism, of the kind of world order, of modern day India, are incredibly bleak and frighteningly bleak. And, you know, I think some of them are right on target, some of them less so. But that kind of contrast is really interesting. When I talked to her, just to belatedly get to your question, she was, you know, I think this is true with a lot of people. I mean, she's extremely soft-spoken and extremely nice and has a very warm laugh. And, you know, I guess when you meet people who their writing can often be fiery and passionate, I'm sure many people are like that. But this is the first time I talked to her, and I was sort of she seemed much more like a typical kind of fiction writing novelist who is sweet and doesn't want to talk about politics and instead wants to talk about literature. And, you know, the sort of intense political side of her did not come across at all.
Huh. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
She was nicer than most novelists, I should say.
No, it's not a necessarily super congenial bunch, but she just comes across as someone whose political zeal would just almost be uncontainable, because it's just like she had this brilliant debut with The God of Small Things, and then she just didn't write any more fiction for like 20 years. So you know, because she was so caught up in her activism. And so that seems like the life story of somebody who just can't suppress her political passions. And those are what she would lead with. And so the fact that she just wanted to talk about literature, I find sort of crafty and fascinating.
She doesn't seem to have the impulse either to spare the reader, you know, like she doesn't seem very solicitous of people's like delicate feelings when she's describing all kinds of torture and mutilation. So I can also, it's surprising to hear that she's sort of holding back if she was doing it out of sort of a polite reluctance to talk politics at this like friendly interview. But sorry,
I would just say two things about her. One is I should probably say that, you know, her political situation in India has often been a little bit dicey, and she's gotten in trouble with the government. So an unwillingness or a not wanting to go on about politics there might be some completely understandable self-preservation instincts involved. But the other thing I was going to say, which is that if you read her nonfiction stuff, which I did, I actually wrote a very nasty piece about her for the New Republic about 10 years ago, which I half regret. But it's very, very full of passion, and it's not – I mean, some people – you know, people write about politics in different ways, but she's someone who has a lot of trouble sort of quoting like UN studies correctly. She's not like a – she's not like a – she's not like a policy wonk. This is passionate. And the best things about her nonfiction books are the passion she brings and the care she shows for the people she meets and their life circumstances. She, as sort of a political writer in other ways, though, I think she's very weak. And in that sense, her political writing makes me think that she would be a better novelist than a political writer versus other people who have spent the last 20 years writing about politics.
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in passion is the word that keeps coming up, because I wouldn't describe her tone as a kind of undilutedly passionate creature. Like it seems tempered with sarcasm a lot. It's very ironic. It's almost in places kind of sing-songy, which was a little bit queasy-making, I felt, when she got to some of the barbarism that she's describing. And she does it in this sort of punny, playful tone. I'm using words from Parul Sehgal's review in The Atlantic, which I thought was brilliant. But she does have this like punny and playful tone that can make it sort of uncomfortable when it's juxtaposed with what she's describing.
I think of that as being one of the sort of hallmarks of Indian fiction, is that there's so much sort of humor, sometimes dark humor, sometimes just slapstick humor in it. There is this sense of the human comedy, although in her case it's like the human tragicomedy, and yeah, part of the sort of savage humor in those scenes, or in the way that she depicts the juxtaposition of like really, I mean, the example that I used in my review was that the in Kashmir, the people, the Kashmiris who are taken taken in by the Indian army or the intelligence. It wasn't always clear to me exactly what agency was at work.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're basically taken to this torture house. You know, it's like this detention center where they are going to be tortured. And it's in an old movie theater. And so when they're sort of signed in, they're like under these Cadbury chocolate signs, you know, in this place that used to be this place of entertainment. And you can't even call it funny, but it just has this, again, really dark, ironic bite to it that that has to do with the fact that so many different qualities and so many different kinds of people are sort of superimposed on each other that you almost can't not have the sort of pulled back perspective that is sort of the hallmark of humor.
I was just wondering with the Kashmir sections, how much of that was intentional? I thought it was chunks of it were pretty hard to follow unless it's like an issue that you happen to be interested in. And I one of the issues of going on in Kashmir is that the political situation there is so... I don't know if you can swear on this podcast, but
yes.
it's so fucked up that, you know, bodies will turn up and nobody really has any idea who's done it and or exactly, you know, the circumstances of which it's just this sort of insane political situation now. And I did wonder how much of that was intentional, although as a reader, I found it somewhat jarring to read.
Yeah, I would say confused is a descriptor I would apply to myself for much of this book, which I think also just exposes my own lack of knowledge about some of the world events that she's addressing. But I did feel that there were kind of axiomatic truths or things that she depended on us to just sort of internalize or have already internalized as obvious or like basic context. And I felt like I was playing catch up for much of the book, sort of like, oh, why does it matter that his name sounds Hindu? Oh, I see. Or like why it wasn't like immediately obvious to me why the Indian government would encourage a principal journalist to like write against their cause. And then I sort of had to like extrapolate outward from what she was saying. And like, I got there eventually, but it, you know, I don't think that she like handholds you. And I guess I wonder whether that's her responsibility, but it was not the easiest reading experience for me.
Well, but also I think that, you know, when I was trying to remember, I did not read reread God of Small Things before reading Ministry. And so I'm just going back on my memory of it. And I remember really loving it, but also being really confused by that novel as well. And part of that is this chronological shuffling that she does, where I think, you know, whatever her reason for doing it, and I feel like I don't see a clear aesthetic reason. So I don't like, I tend to think, why are you doing this? You know, like, what is the point of this? But I mean, I think it probably would be easier to follow without her even having to sort of resort to a lot of exposition if she wasn't into this whole chronological shuffling, so that you don't always, you see the event before the cause, or you see the effect before the cause, and you're often sort of, you don't know what things mean because you don't know what happened just before that. And I don't know, Isaac, you talked to her. Do you have a sense of how time and causality work in this novel? Or did she say anything about that?
No, that's a good question. We should have talked before my interview. That would have been a good question.
We did a little bit.
I did not ask any. Oh, yeah, we did, actually. That's true. I did not ask anything that interesting, but that's a very interesting question. Although I found this book, just to return to God of Small Things, I mean, I agree that some of the chronology stuff, the shifting back and forth was hard in God of Small Things, but I felt that the larger issues, because, you know, the book touches on communist politics and caste and stuff. I felt that was addressed sort of more clearly to readers who are not familiar with some Indian history and politics than this book, which I did think was more difficult.
I just happened to have read enough about the political situation. I felt like I was more or less on solid footing. And then also, you know, I was like, Gujarat, Gujarat. I knew that there had been a riot there. And so when Anjum goes there, I had Wikipedia there. So I was like, I feel it's, you can't, you know, with that resource, it's like, people can't confuse you as much as they used to. But, you know, it definitely is it's sort of like that whole part where they're in Kashmir and Tilo is in Kashmir and then her friend whose name, I forget who's the journalist, she marries him, right? It has this sort of weird Graham Greenish quality.
Yes.
Where everybody has these weird ulterior motives. And that sort of the dark humor reminded me a little bit of Graham Greene as well, even though otherwise her fictional sort of style is so different from his. And one of the things that I really liked in one of the ways that the chronological shuffling I thought was effective was that there's among the several men who are sort of in love with this designer, Tilo, there is a sort of intelligence officer who's going through like a dossier that is either on her or left by her. I mean, he finds it in this apartment that he used to let her live in after she leaves her husband. And then he's also talking about his own work because he has some connection to the stuff that went on in Kashmir. He describes this case that's presented to, you know, an American sort of agent, social agency worker, a petition for asylum. And this lady, this Indian lady, describes like this whole sort of history of trauma and terrorization at the hands of these sort of Muslim extremists. And she and her husband have come to America hoping to find sanctuary. But, you know, she's still afraid that these Muslim extremists are going to follow her and perpetrate more atrocities on her. And he's so sarcastic about it. And you're just like, wow, you know. He's a cold bastard. And it's not till later in the novel that he explains that actually all of the sort of hardships and tortures and that she describes herself as having suffered are things that her husband has done to Kashmiris. And that not only are they lying, but they're actually stealing the stories of his victims, which I feel like in an Arundhati Roy novel, that is like one of the worst things you can do to somebody is to take their story away from them. And that's why he is just like, you know, so nasty about it. But you don't know it at first. And you're just like, what? But then you're put in the position of that American agency worker of sort of thinking, oh, this poor woman, how terrible, those awful Muslim terrorists. And so you're sort of prejudices are engaged and only later do you realize how wrong you were. And I feel like it's effective in that particular instance.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Isaac, what did you think of the sort of cyclical?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Laura, what was specifically the Graham Greene connection you were drawing there?
Oh, I think that character and his sort of cynicism.
The jadedness.
He seemed like a Graham Greene character to me. And then in particular, the sort of black irony about the situation in Kashmir. I don't think that she is a Graham Greene-like novelist because first, she's not a Catholic. And second, she doesn't, she's not sort of jaded in the same way that he is. Although she doesn't obviously have that high of an opinion of human behavior, especially in people in power. But yeah, that was it. It was a sort of and the journalist, the sort of kind of weird double agenda sort of environment that they were in.
Yeah, and also he has a drinking problem, which to me sort of rang that noir.
I mean, I really love that character because I felt like parts of the novel could be a little bit had a little sort of overly fruity flavor, if that makes sense. You know, like the sort of lovable, florid eccentricities of the Hedera were, you know, could seem a bit, almost cute
and precious.
So this character with just his biting and just his, you know, I feel like he's maybe that dark side of her, you know, is speaks through that guy. But I just thought he was just a nice balance to that.
Did you two feel that the book held together cohesively, or was it more that you thought that the different strands all had their sort of worthy things about them or enjoyable things about them, but it didn't kind of hang together? Well, especially now, a couple months after reading it, at least for you, Laura.
When Roy brings Tilo and Anjum together in this sort of bizarre compound that Anjum has built in this graveyard, which is the Ministry of Utmost Happiness, I think that she means us to see them as the sort of locus of everything that is sort of worth saving in India and in humanity. I mean, I don't know that for her there's that huge of a difference. I mean, I think that the whole human condition is represented. It's not just the Indian condition. And so, so you know, that is her ideal society, these sort of odd collection of people who have been left out of the sort of winner circles, but who create this bond. And so that is how she brings, like, that is how she means to bring it together. Whether it feels like the sort of Hedera storyline and the Kashmir storyline really reflect on each other that much in that fruitful of a way, I'm not really sure. I don't know.
Yeah, and also just on a very like basic plot machinations level, I wasn't sure why Tilo left the apartment with the baby to go to this Bardo, to the disaster utopia that's run by Anjum. Like, you know, I could see, like, why not? But, like, it didn't seem like an urgent – or maybe one of you can clarify for me, like, why was that, like, such a necessary move?
Is that because that's where the baby is?
No, she has the baby. No.
She has the baby. And so is she bringing the baby back to Anjum?
Yeah, but there is no back. Anjum didn't – like, Anjum expressed a liking for the baby when Anjum encountered the baby. But I guess I just didn't really understand. Like, it felt like there needed to be some sort of, like, revelatory, inevitable moment that brought those two plot lines together and, like, oh, I see why it's necessary for her to go live in the graveyard with Anjum now. But it just felt like a complete, like, why not? Yeah. You know?
Well, I mean, it's hard to raise a baby on your own. I mean, I saw her as reaching the point where her isolation just didn't work for her anymore, and she wanted to find some kind of community, and this was the community that she found.
I was just going to ask, Laura, you mentioned this earlier kind of about her style and Indian writers. Are there either of you, I mean, any other writers you think that that she reminds you of, or you think she's doing something similar to?
Well,
I
mean, to me, her biggest influence seems to be Garcia Marquez.
Yeah.
And that, you know, but there is just this way that I feel like so many Indian novels that I've read, whose names are not coming to me right now, from Salman Rushdie to Rohinton Mystery, if that's how his name is
That's
pronounced,
correct.
Have this sort of slightly epic, but mostly it's mostly just the sense that when you have all these people together in this kind of dense condition, everyone sees each other's flaws all the time, and that the only real kind of survival mechanism is humor. And so, you know, like, is there ever like an Indian family novel without like seemingly like a half dozen aunties in it who are just provide all of this great sort of running commentary on what's going on and who are hilarious? And it's one of the great things about Indian fiction, for me, is the aunties that seem almost inevitable, and they're what they have to say. They're like this kind of chorus that I find really, like, whenever they turn up, I'm like, ah, I love this. So, you know, it's just a taste.
A lot of people have made the Marquez connection just in terms of the magical realism that she seems to use somewhat sparingly, I think, here, just mostly with animals who are slightly more human than you expect them to be. But this is a weird, and maybe you guys will fruitfully shoot this down because it could be wrong, but it sort of reminded me of Franzen in that she has written this sprawling novel that is seeking to capture like an entire country's deepest sensibilities, and sort of there's the surface plot, and then there's all this sort of like thematic material underneath about like the national character and the history and sort of individual relationships that are then blown out into political dynamics. And so, yeah, I don't know. Isaac, did it remind you of any particular writers?
That's another writer that I've interviewed that I haven't read a word of. No, I actually that's actually interesting to me about the looking at a country in that way. I think Marquez is right. You know, it's funny. I found an interview with Roy where she was asked about the Rushdie influence, and she said, I'll just read you guys what she said. She says, I think that the comparison to Salman has been just a lazy response. When in doubt, if it's an Indian writer, compare them to Salman because he's the best known Indian writer. When I say this, I feel bad because I think it sounds like I don't think very highly of him, because I do. He's a brilliant writer. I think critics have a problem when a new writer comes along because they want to peg an identity on them. I mean, I think that that's broadly a good critique, but I do think that she's probably pretty influenced by Rushdie. It's kind of hard to believe she isn't. And some of the playfulness in this book really did remind me of both Garcia Marquez and Rushdie. And they and themselves are two writers who are compared a lot. So this is not just an Indian thing. But so that definitely stuck out to me. And the aunties thing that Laura was saying, it actually reminded me a little bit of White Teeth.
Huh. Yeah.
The early sections of White Teeth.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I just find that Indian fiction is often capable of being serious without being solemn. And that's one of the sort of strengths of the national literature, that American literature has this incredible rich tradition of humor, but always this ambivalence about it and this feeling that it's not really... it lessens the sort of weight of a work. And it's always been this kind of weird dichotomy in the way Americans look at their national literature that I don't think Indians suffer from.
Yeah. Although I do have to like return to just like my profound discomfort with like some of the effects of that tone, just like the sort of chiming, jingly, tinkly quality to the way that she writes when she's writing about things that are truly horrific. I understand that this is like existing in a tradition and it was very effective, but it also just weirded me out.
Well, I wouldn't put that particular quirk in with the sort of like, I don't think that's something that you see a lot in Indian fiction. I'm talking more about the sort of a kind of a comic sense of human character, which I think is another thing that she might share with Franzen, although he's much more interested in really lifting up the hood of these characters and finding out every little thing that makes them work, you know. And I don't think she's that interested in sort of excavating her characters psychologically.
That's a really good point. They are kind of cartoonish. Like they're
a little bit.
They sort of embody different social movements, and they You can definitely differentiate between them, but there's not like a kind of recognition that you feel like, oh yes, like I've experienced that shade of anger or heartbreak or attraction or whatever.
Well, there's a distance. You know, when Anjum comes back from Gujarat, she has suffered this trauma and she can't, like, for most of the book, you have no access to it. You know, you right. only know how she behaves. And so you're kind of, you know, she's one of the two main characters and you're really shut out of what is like one of the defining events of her life until pretty late in the book. So you're, you know, you are pushed back from the characters to a certain degree.
Well, I also, I mean, I've been thinking about Katie's Franzen thing, and then you just mentioned Gujarat, but, you know, I think with Franzen and his sort of, his both ability and sort of desire to encompass broad ideas and themes, you know, to sort of describe America or whatever it is that, you know, he's been described as trying to do. You know, I do think there's something similar going on here. And it did, the Gujarat thing, I think, you know, in many ways is kind of the defining event in India of the last several decades, just because not just the people who died, but also it was presided over by the man who's currently the prime minister and is sort of an embodiment of the political moment and ideological moment right now in India. So I totally got that. It did feel a little bit to me like I remember thinking before I read the book that, you know, she's been working on a book for 20 years. It's going to have to address Gujarat. And I don't know that that's a great place to be in. And I did feel like with the book that its effect on the characters was less powerful. And it did feel slightly forced to me. So I do think that that's a danger, as there is in sometimes with Franzen doing the same thing. I don't know if I made any sense there.
No, definitely. And I think the difference, one of the differences for me is that I think Franzen has a stronger sense of shape, or his novels are just they have more of a shape, and this felt like a stew. Like her mode of including everyone is to just throw everyone in a bucket, and I think he sort of I'm not sure exactly how to.
He has an overarching structure that he's working on. At least. You know, there's a certain bagginess in the corrections, but I think Freedom had a definite, was formed. You know, I'll say in her defense that when Isaac, before I had even read the book and when Isaac was going to interview her and he messaged me and he said, is there something that I should ask her? And I was like, oh, I can't really remember. And, you know, I really have to go back and read what I wrote about God of Small Things. I'm not going to have time to reread it and blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, I haven't read it yet. And I'm a little bit hesitant because I feel like in the two decades that have come between reading the two books, I've lost a lot of my tolerance for really sort of highly figurative literary prose that just is highly figurative for its own sake, you know, just to be literary. And more and more, I'm like, God damn it, will you cut to the chase? You know, why can't you just say this in a straightforward way? To me, that has become far more my literary standard than the sort of like cascading clauses and, you know, the weird, you know, kind of very archly unusual metaphors or whatever.
Do you think that's? Oh, go on.
She just had me because she has the ability to sort of put some pressure on the language in a way that does not test my patience, which I really respect because sometimes my patience is really just hanging by a thread. And she also understands, I think, that that like the effect of great fiction often has more to do with sort of underlying metaphors than like sentences that are very beautiful. Mm-hmm. So the metaphor of the sort of shanty town compound in the graveyard which I think is her metaphor for the whole novel. You know, it's sort of built one component at a time rather than under an overarching plan. It just keeps yielding more and more. You know, the more you think about it, the more you get out of it, which is kind of the definition of literature, as opposed to something that makes you go, oh, how pretty. And so I had that sort of wariness going in, but then she just had me. I mean, I really like her prose style. I really like the way that she puts together a metaphor that she understands, that it's sometimes a structure that is underlying a huge section of the book. It's not just a turn of a phrase. And I guess those would be called conceits if I was using more precise literary terminology. The conceit of that, of the ministry itself is just, I think, I just got so much out of it. And so I was like, oh yeah, she is really great. And then I remembered that what confused me before was not so much the language, like not so much like language that is just sort of so overworked, as it was the chronology issue and the way that she kept breaking the relationship between cause and effect so that I didn't really know where I was.
I mean, I think though also what you're saying, Laura, about language and your tolerance for it, I mean, it just depends also on how good underlying, you know, the characters in the story are. I mean, you know, just to go back to Rushdie, I mean, this guy who has been doing this in all of his books, and when it works, as it did in Midnight Children and Shame, it's phenomenal and astonishing. And even as someone who doesn't really like that kind of writing generally, I can appreciate it. But then you look at Salman Rushdie post-Shame and he's so bad. He's so bad, right. Yeah. I mean, there are passages in – I wrote a long piece about him and had to go read all of his novels. And, I mean, there are passages in some of his later books which are, I mean, as bad as anything a great writer could write. Because when you don't have that underlying, you know, foundation of characters in a story and you start using language like that, it can just go quickly off the rails.
Oh, boy. That is so true. Yeah. Yeah. When the language seems to be just language for its own sake, the pitfalls are many.
I also think that there is a quality to her language that feels very disciplined, like these very rigorously composed, beautifully crafted passages, like the one where Tilo and Musa? Have sex. That was a beautiful, that was just, I mean, it was sexy, but it was just like gorgeously written. And I think that...
But also it's simply written, too.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is that she's adopting this rhythm. Should I read it? I think I quote it in my piece so I can.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, that was a great piece. There's so many things I want to talk to you about in that piece. But yes, please go ahead.
All right. So this is very, very romantic, which is just such an unusual thing to find in a novel that is also as bitter as this one can be. But you know, it isn't cloying, I don't think. I don't know. Isaac, you might have a different opinion. But this is how it reads. They had always fitted together like pieces of an unsolved and perhaps unsolvable puzzle. The smoke of her into the solidness of him. The solitariness of her into the gathering of him. The strangeness of her into the straightforwardness of him. The insouciance of her into the restraint of him. The quietness of her into the quietness of him.
Yeah, that doesn't do it for me. But hey, everyone's got their own.
Katie and I are like, oh.
Yeah. Well, you know, God bless you both.
But it's interesting that none of the words that she uses there are really like insouciance is probably the only remotely fancy word. She cuts down on the fanciness of the word when she is turning up the rhythm of her description of these two people who just fit together so perfectly. It's not too much, you know? It's not, you know, when, like you said, she's disciplined. She's turning one knob down when she's turning the other knob up.
Yeah, and I also love how it ends with two things that they have in common, alike. That, and also just because, as you point out in your review, this is a book about sort of overflowing the divisions and the boundaries between people. And this is a very mechanical description of overcoming barriers and how exactly that works. So I felt that thematically it was also kind of central to the book.
Yeah, I agree. And it is about love, which I think, if you know, to go back to your original question, I think that despite all of the sort of horrors and other and sort of political considerations and historical elements that are pulled into this novel, that's really the theme of it is love.
Isaac, I'm like waiting for some cutting remark to puncture our conclusion here.
I didn't love the writing of that scene, but I was also I'm attracted to what you guys are saying, and it's interesting. But I don't have anything to add.
Well, how did you feel about the writing style in general, Isaac?
I actually liked it broadly. I mean, I think I alluded to this earlier. I didn't feel like the book totally fit together as a whole, but I liked it, and I thought it was pretty compelling, and I was a little worried I was going to be kind of opposed to it. And I think I actually liked the book more than a lot of people did, as I think you did too, Laura.
Well, we should talk about Parole's piece. Katie, would you care to speak to it? She's now the one of the daily book critics of the New York Times, although this review that she wrote appeared in The Atlantic. Do you think you could summarize some of her objections to the book?
I can say some of the things that like keep sticking in my mind about it. One is that she notes that this isn't a novel per se. She observes that sort of stonework and gravestones are important motifs that keep coming up, and the book itself resembles a monument. And she says that she thinks that perhaps the book is less kind of like a textured description of life in India or life on Earth, and more of an offering to the people who have suffered and died due to all of this violence and brutality. And as such, the characters are less human than symbols. There is a lot in that review. Another thing that was really interesting to me is she characterizes the graveyard as a kind of Eden, but a reverse Eden that is built not on innocence, but on sort of weary and accepting experience, which I found very moving and very apt, especially because I think that Anjum herself, as this kind of integration of opposites, a sort of restless integration of opposites, is someone who is sort of continually coming to terms with contradiction and paradox and sort of knitting those together.
Now, that's interesting because Eden is at the beginning, you know, the myth of Eden is the beginning of history, but maybe it's also a reverse Eden because it's sort of happening at this sort of end point of history, because the book is definitely very fatalistic in a certain way. I mean, there is a sort of, I mean, what you say about your interview with her, Isaac, really resonates for me, because we could call her an activist, but there's this sense that she just doesn't believe that this is ever going to change.
Yeah, there's definitely like a ramshackle post-apocalyptic vibe to this. I mean, it is a cemetery too.
Yeah.
And something that I loved that you had pointed out, Laura, was that for someone so invested in tearing down unnecessary walls, sort of the most powerful wall that you can create between two people is between a living person and a dead person. And so she's kind of transgressively testing that border too.
Every bedroom has a grave in it. Yeah. So the person basically is sleeping with a corpse. Yeah. It's kind of an amazing image, you know, like the idea of just living with the dead. But, you know, many societies feel that way. So, you know, I'm not entirely sure if she means by that we should not forget the dead, or if she just means that soon you will be dead. You know, it's a kind of a I mean, one of the great things about that metaphor is that it eludes being decoded in a way that all great metaphors do.
And doesn't Musa say something like, all of the Kashmiris who seem to be alive are actually dead? That he has some sort of prophetic, difficult to decipher statement to that effect.
I did think that knowing that she had been raised as a Syrian Christian, and that her first novel was about the Hindu caste system, I do sometimes wonder if there isn't a tension between like a cyclical like the Judeo-Christian tradition is very linear, like we're going in a certain direction. And this is where we started, and this happened along the way, and it's a vector. History is a vector, and it's headed in this one direction towards the Last Judgment and then heaven. But that's not exactly the Hindu view of how history plays out. And in a certain way, it might make it harder to have the same sort of level of reformist zeal if you sort of think that things are going to repeat over and over again. I don't know, Isaac, what do you think about that? I feel like you've read more Indian literature than either of us.
Well, no, I mean, I was just thinking about it in terms of what you said about her books kind of jumping back and forth.
Yeah.
The lack of kind of linear. But, her political writing, it's very kind of doom laden. That kind of I don't know what she would call herself, maybe a radical, but it's all kind of very capitalism is destroying the earth, and it's destroying people's souls, and it's destroying their environment, and it's destroying their ability to make a nice life, and it's overwhelmingly bleak without much sense of rebirth. At least, I haven't read her nonfiction now for several years, but that's how I remember it.
So she presents herself, her political writing is more like she's just bearing witness. She's not saying, she's not advocating so much.
No, she's doing both. I mean, sometimes she writes, she writes about kind of environmental destruction and dams in India. That was an early thing. And then she traveled with all these Maoists who are in these tribal areas in India that are fighting the government for land and resources. And those are not really, they're bearing witness in one sense, but they're also, her point of view is very clear. And that's how she got into trouble in India for saying things about the Maoists, which were not appreciated by the central government. And I think we're broadly thought by a lot of people as being slightly naive, even people who think that many tribal people in India have been screwed over by development and by the central government.
So there is this sort of weird tension between like the idea that, if we are doomed, then what is the point of sort of agitating for change? Like,
I just find that very admirable about her. I mean, I don't agree with her on everything politically, but she is someone who puts herself out there and is willing to risk, risk things. And also, as someone who's so kind of pessimistic about where India is headed, is willing to speak up and try to make the least bit of change. And I think that's incredibly admirable.
We're circling back to the novelist self versus activist self. And I just wonder whether the activist self is sort of shaking her head at this like impulse to, like we have a character who's reincarnated basically, right? Like baby Jabin dies and then another baby Jabin emerges into the narrative. And I just wonder if a part of her is sort of shaking her head and saying, there's no way that would work in the real world, or whether these two selves are knit together more sort of fluidly than
It does seem like the redemption that she sees is almost entirely on a private, intimate level. I mean, the love between particularly a mother and a child, even if it's not the biological mother, but the sort of women, even if they're not, you know, they weren't necessarily born women, but, you know, who want, like, the maternal love seems to be something that that is like the counterpart to all of the sort of brutality that gets depicted in the just the general coldness and heartlessness that gets depicted in the rest of the book. Just this instinct when you see this vulnerable creature to sort of take it in and take care of it and raise it and you know, pour your care into it. And that is like the, you know, the intimate or the personal life is the subject of the novel. And if she feels like that's the only place where there's anything good in the world, then it would make sense that her novels have a little bit more hope in them than her political writing.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yeah, we're running up a little bit on time. So I wonder if either of you have additional points you'd like to raise.
I think that was one of the best podcasts anybody's ever done. We should leave it right there.
Wow.
I hope
No,
keep
no, that sounded
on.
Too sarcastic. I thought it was a really good conversation.
Yeah.
That's all I meant.
It was.
Yeah, sorry. No, this was a pleasure.
How you know that it was actually a worthwhile book, is that you can have like a conversation about it. And that's not true of all novels.
That's true.
You know, some novels you could talk about forever and they're just bad. But, you know, I think that if you're sort of on the line about it, there's enough going on that both aesthetically and in terms of like the content or what she's trying to say, that, you know, like it's just like that metaphor. You know, you just, the more you look at it, the more you see, and the more you see, the more you want to go on looking is to me really like the definition of art.
And definitely, like, if your aesthetic is everything but the kitchen sink,
there's
plenty of material.
You do have to be kind of, you do have to toughen up a little bit. Like, if you're a sensitive soul and you can't deal with violence or cruelty, then I would stay away from Ministry of Utmost Happiness.
Yeah.
Well, it's one not thing a, that... your cute Indian novel. It's not that, you know. It's pretty bloody-minded in some
ways. Yeah, this is not like a Bollywood take. But one thing that we do like to do on the audiobook club at the end of a conversation is go around and just say whether we would recommend the title. So I'll start with you, Isaac. Would you recommend The Ministry of Utmost Happiness to our readers or listeners?
I would, yeah.
All right, one yay.
Sorry. Miller. Was I supposed to say more?
No, you're fine.
You know, my belief always in recommending books is that you need to know who you're making the recommendation to. Like, if it's a person who really, like I said, is squeamish or very, very sensitive or doesn't like a sort of sprawling narrative, then no, I would not say that, you know. But otherwise, yes. I mean, I would never say, if I knew that the person I was recommending it to was sort of well-disposed to some of the elements in this, I would say absolutely yes. But definitely it's not for every single reader.
Yeah. I would say my reading experience of this was pretty uneven. There were parts that that washed over me and I found very rewarding, and other parts that I was incredibly frustrated I was ill at ease. But I would definitely recommend it if you have access to Laura Miller or Isaac Chotiner to talk about it with you afterwards. otherwise, on the fence if you have nothing else to read and you're curious. Anyway, thank you guys so much for joining me with this. This was great.
It was really fun. Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Katie.
The homepage for the Slate Book Review is slate.com/books. You'll find the show pages for this and every episode of the Audiobook Club at slate.com/ABC. Visit our Facebook page where you can leave a comment on this episode. That address is facebook.com/slateABC. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, which helps other people discover the show. Search for Slate Audiobook Club in the iTunes store and don't forget to leave a comment while you're there. Slate's Audiobook Club is part of the Panoply Network. Find out more about all of our great podcasts at panoply.fm. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch, and thanks for the assist, AC Valdez. Andy Bowers is our chief content officer. For Isaac Chotiner and Laura Miller, I'm Katie Waldman. Thanks for listening.